Campbell, and one of the slave drivers, Dewey Robinson, a big, bulky, wonderful man, caught me just before I hit those sizzling lamps. It scared the hell out of me. But otherwise, I was fine. Yet, as rough as the hours and conditions were, the food was terrific. For the Emperor's banquet scenes, a catering service wheeled into the studio whole, hot, roasted pigs, barbecued baby lamb, sides of juicy beef, and mountains of fruit and pastry. It was the most delicious food I'd ever tasted in my entire life. I especially enjoyed the ostrich eggs. They were real ostrich eggshells filled with rich, creamy custard. Maybe I was just hungry for real food after all those donuts. I gobbled that stuff up day after day while the camera ground and the lights frizzled my rope wig until I became horribly sick to my stomach. It was years before I could touch custard again. One of the worst things the studio people did was shave off my eyebrows. We were all trying to look like Jean Harlow. Now, God forbid that I should ever find myself on a desert island without an eyebrow pencil. It's the first thing I reach for every morning. The only girl I know who managed to grow hers back again was Ginger Rogers, and even then, it took her years. Roman Scandals was supposed to be filmed in 6 weeks, but it stretched into 6 months. I loved everything about movie making. The money, meeting so many different kinds of people, the high excitement of each day, the fantastic talent of the technicians who could put the Colosseum on a 30-foot stage. But my movie career might have ended there. And I'd have been a $50-a-week model in New York again, except for another remarkable stroke of good luck. One day, a light, graceful young man came on the set and called to me. "Hello, Lucille." Then he introduced himself as Russell Markert and reminded me that we had already met in New York. He was going to be the choreographer for a big film, Moulin Rouge, starring Constance Bennett and Franchot Tone. Russell was visiting the Roman Scandal set to see if he could pick some showgirls for his film. Now, I've got long legs and a sense of rhythm, but a tin ear when it comes to distinguishing musical measures. Russell knew I'd never be a Ruby Keeler, but he said he could teach me what was required, and so, just as Roman Scandals was through, the Goldwyn girls were loaned out en masse to Daryl Zanuck at 20th Century Fox. That's the way it worked back then. Sometimes I'd be loaned out, and I didn't even know what the movie was about or who was in it. I wouldn't even know the title. I just show up at the studio at a certain hour, walk through the scene, maybe say one line. I never knew I was in Broadway Through a Keyhole with Russ Colombo until a few weeks ago when I saw the film for the first time. Life was hectic, but the money was good. I thought I was doing great until Russell Markert impressed upon me the necessity of saving. "You don't have to start a savings account with $1,000, he used to tell me. You can start with $1. On his advice, I put $25 into the bank every payday. Otherwise, he said, I would never survive the parched periods between pictures. By this time, I was determined to stay in Hollywood. I would do what I could to make sure I'd survive the long haul. Under Russell Markert's prodding, I bought a bicycle to save taxi fare. I enjoyed pedaling through the rosy dawn past the little white bungalows, each with its garden of pink camellias and purple bougainvillea. I pictured my poor family back in New York City in their grimy walk-up flat, and pictured myself, too, back in the modeling business. I worked long, hard hours without complaint, but some nights, after hours of dance rehearsals, my legs would really ache. One evening, as Russell was walking along Hollywood Boulevard, a yellow cab shot past him with a familiar-looking green bicycle on the running board. He then recognized me at the wheel and the cabbie in the back seat with a disgruntled expression, both arms out the window hanging onto the bicycle. After a 16-hour day, I found that the bike ride home was just too much. One of my few extravagances was to telephone Dee Dee in New York. I'd say hello and then start to bawl. After 3 minutes of this, Dee Dee would start worrying about the charges and she'd hang up. I told them they were all coming to Hollywood as soon as I saved up their fares. And that week, I'd try very hard to save an extra $5 or $10. It was in Hollywood that I finally got Johnny out of my system. The reason was another older man, a handsome, sophisticated matinee idol of the London and New York stage. Ralph Forbes was about 30 and had just been divorced from Ruth Chatterton. He could play Ibsen or Noel Coward. It was terribly British, and so was his whole family. They impressed the hell out of me. But when he proposed, I cooled off in a hurry. I just couldn't picture myself in his rarefied British atmosphere. I'm not the crooked finger and teacup type. Ralph had wealth, fame, talent, looks. Why would he need me? I was more than half in love with him, but I managed to turn him down. Almost immediately, he eloped to Yuma with a young British actress, Heather Angel. And that abrupt switch convinced me that I had made the right decision. I decided to forget about romance and to concentrate on my career. In rapid succession, I had brief walk-on parts in Murder at the Vanities, Bottoms Up, and Affairs of Cellini. While making one Goldwyn picture, I had a cough, and as we did our dance routine, I kept hacking. Finally, Busby Berkeley glowered at me and said, "Please!" And I said, "I'm sorry, but I can't help it." I probably had a 103-degree temperature as well. Somebody handed me some cough syrup, and I gulped down half the bottle, unaware of its codeine content. Then I crept into the wings and fell asleep. I slept so soundly that it was hours before they found me. Mr. Goldwyn never forgot that, because I held up production for such a long time. After I'd been in Hollywood for about a year, I went back east for a short visit. I stayed with Grandma Peterson in her narrow, dark little house in Jamestown, where I had been so miserable as a child. My stepfather Ed was living with her then. He was not working and was very glad to see me. My Hollywood success pleased him. I told him how much his encouragement years before had meant to me. In Hollywood, of course, I was still an unknown, but in Jamestown, the newspapers made a big thing out of the premiere of Roman Scandals. "Jamestown's own Lucille Ball," the ads ran, with a full-length picture of me, mostly big eyes and that knee-length wig. Overnight, I found myself a local celebrity. The Jamestown Journal sent a reporter to interview me at grandmother's. He asked how the 12 Goldwyn girls were doing, and I told him that in one short year, 8 had vanished. Here's what eventually happened to them. One married an English lord, another became the mistress of a Texas cattle king and ultimately bore him 4 children, and a third became the lifelong mistress of another fabulously wealthy man. A 4th Goldwyn girl of 1933 lived high and handsomely, then died of tuberculosis in the charity ward of a Hollywood hospital. 4 others were happily married and raised families. Back in Hollywood after my brief trip east, I got showgirl parts in a Bulldog Drummond film, Nana, and The Bowery. In all these pictures, I was just part of the scenery, strolling past the camera and chiffon and feathers. Friends kept telling me, "You should be in comedy." I burned to get some real acting experience. So when I was offered a stock contract at Columbia, I jumped at the chance. I took the slapstick parts the other starlets spurned and never whined about the siphon water and pies in the face. I considered myself lucky to be paid while learning a business I adored. We often worked past midnight. I did whatever was asked of me. My wages at Columbia were $75 a week. Each payday, I dropped into the bank across the street and added to my survival account. After Freddie graduated from high school, he came out and found a job at the Trocadero Supper Club. Together, we rented a small furnished bungalow on Ogden Drive in Hollywood for $85 a month and spent every spare moment fixing it up in anticipation of Dee Dee and Daddy's arrival. One of the biggest stars at Columbia in those days was Ann Southern, who was known for her extravagance and good taste. She was also loved for her generous heart. One day, I got up enough courage to ask her advice about fixing up our little rented house. I was a nobody on the lot, yet she took the time to come over. She arrived in a blue Alfa Romeo with a uniform chauffeur and dripped up the walk in a full-length mink. I was in dungarees and a bandana scrubbing the floor. The place was a hodgepodge of patterned wallpaper, scuffed floors, and broken-down furniture. Anne raised her delicately arched eyebrows and very kindly advised me to cover everything possible with white enamel paint and later add roughly white curtains and fluffy blue scatter rugs. She knew we only had pennies to spend, but thanks to her good taste, the place became fresh and sparkling, a blue and white dollhouse. Finally, Freddie and I were ready. So excited I could hardly talk, I phoned Dee Dee and told her to make reservations on the Super Chief. I hung up, and 10 minutes later the studio called to say that I'd been fired. Columbia was giving up its stock company, and we had all been laid off. Forever. That night, I had a date with a wonderful boy, Dick Green, whose brother was Johnny Green, the songwriter. Well, I lost my job, I told him. How do you like that? Out of the clear blue sky. There's a showgirl call at RKO at 9 o'clock tonight, he told me. Say, did you ever model at Bergdorf Goodman's in New York? When I said no, I hadn't, Dick told me. Well, say you did, because Bernard Newman's picking the models. The name meant nothing to me. I said, okay, and went right over to RKO. They liked my height and my manner, and so I was called into the front office. Mr. Newman asked me if I had worked for Bergdorf Goodman, and I said, oh, my, yes. And when he pressed me for details, I gave him a lot of phony dates. He kept saying, really? And, that's very interesting. And finally he said, well, I know you're telling a great white lie because I was at Bergdorf's that whole time and I never laid eyes on you. Then he added with a twinkle, but you got the job. After that, we became great friends and are to this day. I look Bernie up every time I go to New York, but he never lets me forget how I fibbed my way into Roberta. This was my second major break, for it led to a 3-month contract which stretched into 7 years. 5. The next day, I phoned home and told Dee Dee the bad news about losing my job. Come anyway, I said, but come by bus. George Raft was going with Virginia Penn, a friend of mine, and we often double-dated. When George heard that my family was arriving in Hollywood, that generous man insisted upon lending me his car and $65 to welcome them in style. We could hardly greet the folks on bicycles, so in great glee, Freddie and I rolled off to the bus terminal in style. When Dee Dee saw the little white bungalow on Ogden Drive in Hollywood, she burst into tears. This was one of the few times I ever saw her give way to her feelings. She came prepared to find work as a sales lady, armed with many written recommendations, but I put my foot down. Her working days were over, I told her. In the warm sunshine, Daddy seemed to regain some of his old jaunty spirit. The milkman, the trash collector, the retired people on the block all became his fast friends, drinking coffee with him and listening to his political harangues in the garage. This was Daddy's workshop and also his office, complete with a desk and a couple of old chairs. I really think we added 10 years to his life by moving him to California. And Dee Dee's migraine headaches eventually vanished. Keeping that household afloat was the greatest thing that ever happened to me. I cherished every minute of it. It was tough going financially at times. I was earning only $50 a week at RKO, and Freddie was making about the same. But it gave me a real purpose in life. I felt wanted and needed, and I was grateful to have the family together again. Each morning, I'd get up at 6 to reach the RKO studios on Gower Street by 7. The long, low plaster buildings of the old RKO lot house Desilu Studios today. In fact, the same guard greets me at the front gate. When he says, "Hello, Lucy," these mornings, he reminds me that as an eager young starlet, I disliked that nickname. My idols were Carol Lombard and Katharine Hepburn. I could visualize Lucille on theater marquees, but not Lucy. So I wound up as a showgirl in Roberta, modeling clothes. The movie starred Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, the hottest song and dance team in Hollywood. One of the clichés of Hollywood is behind every successful actress are a hairdresser and a mother. Hairdressers come and go, but Ginger Rogers had only one fabulous mother, a woman who played mother to many of us as we worked our way up. Pandra Berman once remarked that Lila Rogers charged about the set like a mother rhinoceros protecting her young. Lila was petite, dynamic, practical, and shrewd. She was also quite as sexy and beautiful as her daughter. One way or another, Lila Rogers generally got her own way. Her daughter was her Galatea, a star she created. Ginger was just another bright-faced kid from Texas with one Broadway show under her belt when she came to RKO. She was not a great dancer, and she couldn't sing or act. She had to learn all these things and at the same time keep up with the great performer, Fred Astaire, who was also one of the hardest taskmasters on Earth. Fred would practice one dance step, which would take about 4 seconds on the screen, for 3 hours or more. He expected the same perfection from Ginger. They'd dance 16, 18 hours a day until their feet were literally bleeding. Leela had started Ginger on the vaudeville circuit when she was barely 14. Leela wrote her a new act every week, including songs and dances, and made her costumes on a portable sewing machine. She was her daughter's press agent, business manager, and school teacher as well. When I knew them, Leela was still keeping Ginger hopping with lessons of all kinds. Painting, sculpture, tennis, geography, history, and the great books. Leela was great on improving Ginger, or any of us who happened to be lucky enough to be around. Ginger and Fred had little in common and battled through every picture, yet moviegoers found them one of the great romantic teams of all time. Hollywood at first didn't know what to make of Fred. He was skinny, balding, treated girls like a kindly uncle. He'd been in Flying Down to Rio with Dolores del Rio. She wasn't a good dancer and was heavy at the time. Fred thought the finished movie was a bomb, so the studio decided to get him another girl and add some dance scenes. Fred asked for Ginger, having helped her in New York with some of her dance routines in Girl Crazy as a favor to George Gershwin. So a small part was added to Flying Down to Rio for Ginger, and overnight, she and Fred were a hit. The gay divorcee followed. Leela used to say that Ginger was Fred's best dancing partner because she imitated his body movements. When he danced with other girls, they took off, did their own kind of dancing. Ginger had no style of her own, so she borrowed Fred's. Then, to make him appear romantic, she never took her eyes off him. He gave her class as a dancer, and she gave him romantic appeal. Just watching Leela handle Ginger on the set was an education in itself. Leela would go upstairs and say to the bosses, "You know, it would be a lot easier for Ginger if she had a little bit larger dressing room so she could wash her hair there instead of doing it at home. Ginger hasn't asked for this, but we could save 45 minutes every morning if you could just knock out a wall and give her a little more room." Ginger was working so hard that she needed a few assists. She was a sunny, cheerful person, friendly and approachable as a puppy. She never had an entourage to impress other people, as many stars did, still do. She needed a hairdresser right at hand and a choreographer and a secretary and a pressman or two. And when she moved about the lot, they moved too to save her time. When she walked from her dressing room to the set, 7 or 8 people came along. Ginger made 71 A movies in a period of 14 years, including 9 with Fred at RKO. When one of their films was finally in the can, Fred would sail to Europe to recuperate for 6 months. Ginger would start a new movie within 24 hours. The wonderful thing about Leela was that she was mom to a bevy of young struggling starlets. She directed RKO's Little Theater, where promising young people from other studios also came to be tutored by this wise, warm woman. When some young kid at Warner Brothers or MGM was hauled into the clink for drunken driving or some other charge, Mrs. Rogers was usually the first person the cops would telephone. "One of your kids is here," they'd tell her. "Asking for Mom Rogers." And she'd drop everything and hurry to the police station. Just before we started filming Roberta, Leela got a phone call from Pan Berman at the front office. "We've put 4 models under a short-term contract for Roberta," he told her. "3 of them may be star material. Then there's a kid named Lucille Ball. Don't pay any attention to her. Bernie Newman hired her. I don't know why. She's great at parties, real funny kid, but I can't see any future for her in movies." Leela thought otherwise. She told me years later, "I noticed the twinkle in your eyes and the mobile face, which is a must for comedy. I also sense a depth and a great capacity for love." "What would you give to be a star in 2 years?" Leela asked me when I was first getting to know her. I gulped and answered, "Gee, what do you mean?" "Would you give me every breath you draw for 2 years? Will you work 7 days a week? Will you sacrifice all your social life?" I had observed Ginger's dedication on the set, and I knew that Leela meant every word. "I certainly will," I promised. "Okay," she said. "Let's start." Leela was the first person to see me as a clown with glamour. She pulled my frizzy hair back off my brow and had a couple of my side teeth straightened. Then she sent me to a voice teacher and told me to lower my high, squeaky voice by 4 tones. Lily used to say, "A comedian who does Ginger's style of comedy has to be good-looking. You should be able to sit and watch her read the telephone book, and with either Lucille or Ginger, you can." Mrs. Rogers would arrive at her theater building on the RKO lot after lunch. Whoever wasn't working on some movie set would join her then. The rest of us would arrive at 6 p.m., when shooting generally stopped. To break down our reserve, she put us in improvisations. At 3 in the morning, we'd be begging, "Oh, please, Mom, just one more. Let's just do one more." Then we'd be going home at 4, punchy with weariness, but feeling so wonderful. To me, the live theater was it, and still is. Leela mounted us in good plays and rehearsed us steadily for 4 or 5 months. Then we'd perform the play nightly, except Sundays, for the same length of time. Her productions were an incredible showcase for young talent. Admission to the plays was 25 cents. People flocked to our theater from all over town and from as far as New York. Often, we had directors and producers in the audience, and critics, too. I met Brock Pemberton and his wife backstage one evening. For months after that, he tried to find me a part on Broadway. I soon became part of a small, intimate group centered around Ginger, who was about my age. On weekends, we played tennis, went swimming, double-dated at the Ambassador and the Biltmore. The group included Phyllis Frazier, Ginger's first cousin, who is now Mrs. Bennett Cerf, Eddie Rubin, Florence Lake, and Anita, the face, Colby. Ginger was dating Lee Bowman, Henry Fonda, Jimmy Stewart, and Orson Welles. Often I went along. It was such a busy, happy time for me. Leela took the dungarees off us and put us into becoming dresses. She ripped off our hairbands and made us do our hair right. If we went to see a big producer in his office, she cautioned us to put on full makeup and look like somebody. She made us read good literature to improve our English and expand our understanding of character. She drummed into us how to treat agents and the bosses upstairs. Leela believed that sex is more of a hindrance than a help to a would-be star. More actresses have made it to the top without obvious sex appeal than with it. Leela taught us to dedicate ourselves to our work and to ignore the nerve-wracking rumors of calamity issuing from the front office. I never played politics at RKO, and it wouldn't have helped if I had. RKO had 11 presidents in 14 years. Leela advised us to work on ourselves and pay no attention to those corporate machinations. Leela wouldn't tolerate anyone taking advantage of her charges. One producer at RKO kept sending her his protégés to include in her classes. Leela kept throwing them out until her patience was exhausted. One day, another protégé arrived, saying coyly, "Mr. X sent me." Leela picked up the telephone and told that producer, "I am not Madam Rogers, and my workshop is not a whorehouse. This girl you sent me today has no talent whatsoever and no future in the theater. So put her where you had her last night and keep her there." That was the last we saw of those gamey dames. My first contract at RKO was for 3 months. This was extended to 6 months, and then to a year. On May 12, 1935, our Cleo baby turned 16 and was finally allowed to choose where she wanted to live. She immediately left her father in Buffalo and joined us in Hollywood. Cleo was so happy to have a mother again, she wouldn't let Dee Dee out of her sight. I drove directly from the studio to the bus terminal to get her in my second-hand Studebaker Phaeton, my first car. Cleo was overwhelmed at the sight of a real movie star in full stage makeup, false lashes, big picture hat, and polka dot silk dress. I was back to making $75 a week and thought I had arrived. My contract had been extended to a year, but as 1935 drew to an end, Leela found me in tears. "Last night, at midnight, was the last hour they could pick up my option," I told her. "I guess I'm through." Leela stormed up to the front office and learned that, indeed, I had been dropped. A new president had been installed and was affecting economies by cutting down the payroll. "Very well," Leela shrugged. "If Lucille goes, I go. She's the best student I've got. I'll take her to some other studio and manage her like I do Ginger." The bosses paled at this threat, and I was immediately rehired. Leela told me that the legal department had made a mistake about the date of the option. "They may ask you to take the same salary without a raise this year," she added. And if I were you, I'd take it. So there I was, safe for another year. Leela taught us never to see anyone as bigger or more important than ourselves. But she discouraged outbursts of petty temperament. It was very bad, she said, for a young player to get the reputation of being difficult. This was brought home to me one time when my hot temper got out of hand. I was sitting before a makeup table one morning when the head makeup man, Mel Burns, rudely told me to get out. Katharine Hepburn was on her way down. She had been hired at $2,000 a week and was held in great awe and respect by everyone on the lot. So with one eyebrow and no lipstick on my face, I hurriedly gathered up my things and left. After Mel Burns started working on Hepburn, however, I realized I had left my eyebrow pencil behind. I came back drinking a cup of coffee and stuck my head through the little talking hole into the dressing room. Mel Burns ignored my polite request for the eyebrow pencil and went on applying makeup to Hepburn. I asked him again, and then a third time. He made some stale reply. I had been putting up with this guy for a long time and had had about enough. Suddenly, the coffee cup left my hand and went sailing into the dressing room, narrowly missing Hepburn's celebrated head. A little later, Leela was summoned to the front office. This Lucille Ball is temperamental. We'll have to get rid of her, Mr. Berman said. Of course she's temperamental, or she wouldn't be worth a cent to you or anybody else, Leela flared up. So is Mel Burns, so if you fire her, fire them both. I was in the doghouse, all right. So to show everybody whose side she was on, Leela took me to the commissary for lunch. Hepburn walked over to our table and said soothingly, It's all right, Lucy. Then she added, You'll have to wait until you get a little bit bigger before you can practice temperament. Leela expected all of us to show up at play rehearsals, whether we were in the production or not. As Phil Silvers is fond of saying, If you hang around show business long enough, you learn. We all spent hours and hours in the darkened theater watching rehearsals. We were putting on A Case of Rain with Anita Colby in the lead when Leela called me at 10 o'clock one morning. Anita's sick and can't go on tonight, she announced. Will you take her place? She then explained that there was no time for a full rehearsal. My assistant will go through the lines and moves with you, she said. I had, of course, studied the play and watched the rehearsals, but there's a big difference between this kind of mental approach and the actual performance. I arrived at Leela's theater about 11 a.m. and stayed there all day, until the opening at 8 o'clock that night. I don't know how I did it, but I played the lead without missing a line or a cue, and got 25 more laughs than usual. Afterward, Leela came back to me and said, Lucille, if you're in the theater for 50 years, you'll never face a more difficult task. You've been through the worst that can happen to a performer. I hope you'll always rise to challenges like that. Only recently did I learn from Leela that my jumping in at the last moment was her way of testing me. Anita's sudden illness was a put-up job. Sitting in the back row of Leela's little theater one night was Pandro Berman. He was short, dark, vital, and still in his early 30s, the boy wonder of the industry. He produced all the Astaire Rogers musicals and had often been locked in mortal combat with Leela over Ginger's lines or dances or attention-getting costumes. One of Ginger's bouffant ostrich feather dance gowns almost suffocated skinny Fred. But Leela fought Pan Berman for every feather, and won. As RKO's top producer started to leave the theater after the performance, Leela came up to him and crowed, That was Lucille Ball who played the lead tonight on only a few hours' notice. She's the girl you said had no acting potential. For once, Mr. Berman had no counterattack to the mother rhinoceros. Yes, I know, he told Leela quietly, and stole away. Leela kept telling the RKO producers and directors, I have a passel of good talent, and when you're casting bit parts, I want you to use my students. Director Mark Sandrich came to her one day when he was casting Top Hat, and Leela talked him into giving me a few lines. It was my first real speaking part, and during the filming, I was so nervous and unstrung that I couldn't get the words out. They phoned Leela and told her I wasn't doing well, and would have to be replaced, so Leela hied herself right over to the set. My scene took place in a florist shop where I was supposed to make some biting remarks to some man about Fred sending flowers to Ginger. I stumbled and blew my lines until Leela said to Mark Sandrich, Reverse the lines. It's not in character for the girl to make those biting remarks. Give them to the man. So we reversed the dialogue, and everything worked out fine. My next movie was Follow the Fleet, which was another big splashy Astaire Rogers musical with Betty Grable in one of her early parts. Ginger and Fred sang and danced to Irving Berlin's Let's Face the Music and Dance, I'm Putting All My Eggs in One Basket, We Saw the Sea, and Let Yourself Go. It was based on the stage comedy Shore Leave, with little plot but great songs and dancing. I play Ginger's friend. The picture opened at Radio City Music Hall in February 1936, and shortly afterward, I got my first fan letter, which I still have. It was addressed to the front office and said, "You might give the tall, gum-chewing blonde more parts and see if she can't make the grade. A good gamble." From Follow the Fleet, I went into the second lead of That Girl from Paris with Lily Pons and Jack Oakey. On the set, I clowned continually. One day, an older man came up to me and said, "Young lady, if you play your cards right, you could be one of the greatest comedians in the business." I just gave him a look. I figured he was one of those guys who came around measuring starlets for tights. Then I learned he was Edward Sedgwick, a famous comedy director who had coached Buster Keaton and Jack Haley. Eventually, Ed Sedgwick taught me many comedy techniques, the double take and the eye-rolling bit and how to handle props. He became Desi's mentor and his wonderful, witty wife, Ebba, my confidant. They were both as close as father and mother to us. Russell Markert, Lila Rogers, Ed Sedgwick. These were but a few of the experienced theater people who generously gave me a boost. I have a theory about the assists we get in life. Only rarely can we repay those people who helped us, but we can pass that help along to others. That's why in 1958, I reactivated Lila's theater workshop with 24 talented kids trying to get started in show business. My accountants referred to it as Lucy's Folly, but Marie Torrey called it the most practical workshop in television. I found it a deeply satisfying experience. It was my way of thanking Lila. Freddie, Cleo, Dee Dee, Daddy, and I were all still living in that little three-bedroom rented house at 1344 North Ogden Drive, with 2 fox terriers and 5 white cats. In the same way that I collected animals, Daddy built up a large circle of ne'er-do-wells and underdogs. He suffered a slight stroke at 71, and afterward became garrulous and even more worried about the state of the world. My dates thought him eccentric and a character, especially when he read aloud to them from the Daily Worker while they waited for me. There's no doubt that Daddy's experience with the law and Celeron disillusioned him deeply about democracy. He had worked hard all his life, then overnight everything was taken away from him, unjustly. During the Depression, he saw many of his closest friends also lose their homes and life savings through circumstances beyond their control. The furniture factories in Jamestown closed. The craftsmen were thrown out of work, and after a few weeks or months, most of them were penniless and on relief. And these were master craftsmen, proud, able men. Daddy would complain about the hard lot of the working man, and before we knew it, his garage became the meeting place of radical left-wingers and crackpots. I never saw any of these people, being much too busy working, but Dee Dee often said that they were taking advantage of Daddy's warm heart. He was the softest touch in the whole neighborhood. He would go to the relief board and battle for a total stranger. He was a sincere humanitarian, but also sentimental and unrealistic. For instance, he soon discovered that the corner of Fairfax and Sunset Boulevard, just a block from our house, was a favorite gathering spot of Hollywood's call girls. Daddy would hurry over to some lady of the evening and press a $5 bill into her hand, saying, "Take this and go home. You don't have to work tonight." "Sure, Pop. Thanks a lot," the woman would say. She'd pocket the money, walk around the block, and be back at the same stand 5 minutes later. Daddy gave away his money every week until we finally had to stop giving him any. If we contradicted or crossed him, he became highly emotional. It was easier to agree with him than to risk his having a second stroke. We couldn't keep a maid because he'd immediately tell her she was overworked and underpaid. I got him a job in the carpentry department at RKO, where master woodcraftsmen were scarce. He worked one Monday from 7 till 11 a.m. It took him exactly that long to walk the woodturners out on strike. And they were getting very good money. Until Daddy arrived, it had never entered their minds that they were the least bit underpaid. After his stroke, Daddy was confined a good deal to a rocking chair. There was a tall tree near our sidewalk, which he said interfered with his view of the mountains. "That goddamn tree is in my way," he complained repeatedly. "I'm going to cut it down." I explained this would be against the law. It's not our tree, I told him. It belongs to the city. A few weeks later, he changed his tune.
Well, someday that tree'll blow down in a storm, you'll see.
Sure enough, during a mild sprinkle, the tree toppled over. Then we could see that the roots had been cut, the sod neatly turned back for the operation, and then replaced. Worse than that, the tree fell right on top of my new second-hand Studebaker, which was parked at the curb. It cost me $400 to get it fixed. I was going at such a pace at the studio and in Leela's little theater around this time that I wore myself down to 100 pounds. My normal weight today is 130. While I was in the hospital on a fattening diet, Leela asked me if I wanted a bit part in a play by Bartlett Cormack, Hey Diddle Diddle, which was headed for Broadway. Leela developed not only actors and actresses, but playwrights, too. It never hurts a movie actress to appear in a successful play back east, so I jumped at the chance. It was not a great play, but I enjoyed the junket. Conway Turl was the star, and Alice White played a starlet in this feeble melodrama about life on Eucalyptus Drive in Hollywood. Keenan Wynn, a massive talent with a daredevil personality, was a man in white. We opened the show in Princeton, and the reviewers called me another Hepburn. We moved on to New Haven, and there Conway Turl became seriously ill. So that was the end of the tour. In New York, I moved into a swank 57th Street hotel and then walked over to Fifth Avenue to buy myself a truckload of new clothes. To a newspaper reporter for a New York paper, I said candidly, I'm happy for the first time in my life. I know what I'm doing and where I'm going. I explained that I'd been in love twice, but that I didn't want to get married. I want to be a good comedian, I told the reporter, like Alice Brady or Zazu Pitts. Character actresses last longer. After my big clothes spree, I went up to Jamestown to visit my grandmother Peterson. It was February, and 6 inches of fresh snow lay on the ground to my intense delight. I saw Johnny briefly. He had not married and was still carrying the torch for me, but my feeling for him had cooled to a very small glow of affection. With the arrival of the Depression, Johnny had fallen on hard times. Jamestown was a sad place that winter of 1937. The furniture business was in the complete doldrums. The banks had foreclosed on 4,000 homes and thrown as many families into the street. Johnny asked me for money to pay for his mother's insurance, and I was glad to be able to help him. It was wonderful to be a contract player. Whether you worked or not, you got that paycheck every week. Back in Hollywood, I did another play for Leela, Breakfast for Venora. After the last performance, as I was removing my stage makeup, Leela came backstage with a huge bouquet of red roses. These are for you, she said. But Leela, I said, amazed, what for? Tonight's our last night together, explained Leela. I've taught you everything I can. From now on, you have to put it into practice. I could feel the tears welling up inside me. You mean I'm not coming back anymore? I asked incredulously. No, darling, said Leela. I've had you 2 years, and the studio says that's all. They've got some new students for me. You're through here at the little theater. We both cried a little, and then I didn't see Leela for weeks. As a final favor, she got me a speaking part in Stage Door, which Gregory LaCava directed. He was an outstanding director, but didn't particularly like me. He'd only given me the part, I'm sure, at Leela's prodding. The movie was based on the play by Edna Ferber and George Kaufman about a group of stage-struck girls living together at the Footlights Club. Critic Howard Barnes called it brilliantly written, directed, and acted, a superbly modulated succession of scenes and moods. He added that Ginger Rogers, as Katharine Hepburn's caustic roommate, serves notice that she can act as well as dance. Adolf Manju played the rake play producer and Gail Patrick the opportunistic young girl. Andrea Leeds was the overly sensitive one who committed suicide. Eve Arden and Ann Miller and so many other fine actors had roles in this picture. It was a treat to even be a part of it. I played one of the boarders at the Footlights Club, wearing my hair long and dark, loose and straight, like Hepburn's. It was my first standout part, and afterward, some Hollywood producer's wife, lunching at Chasen's, was overheard to say, "Who was that funny tall girl in Stage Door who went home to Oregon to marry a lumberman?" My next opus was also a big expensive A movie, Having Wonderful Time. Ginger Rogers and Douglas Fairbanks Jr. played the leads in this comedy about 2 weeks at Camp Carefree. Eve Arden, who had been in Stage Door with me, was in the large cast, as well as Phyllis Fraser, Jack Carson, and a new comic named Red Skelton. I even got Cleo a small part. We went on location for 3 weeks to 7,000-foot Big Bear Mountain. I felt literally on top of the world. The movie was a hit at Radio City, and for the first time, I was mentioned in the New York movie reviews. Lucille Ball is faultless as Miriam, one of the harpies. 6. I believe that we're as happy in life as we make up our minds to be. All actors and actresses, no matter how talented or famous, have ups and downs in their careers. It's just the nature of the business. You have to learn to roll with the punches and not take them personally. Ed Sedgwick and Buster Keaton used to tell me about dozens of Hollywood people who ran into trouble. This was comforting, like reading an autobiography and thinking, well, that happened to them too. I'm not the only one. At RKO, I was known as the starlet who never complained. When I began getting small, supporting parts in big A-movies like Stage Door and Having Wonderful Time, the front office brass began to notice me. There was an important producer who was especially kind and encouraging. I liked him and respected his judgment. He had a young wife and small children, and we often spoke about the problems of raising a family. Then, I don't know quite how it happened, this producer fell in love with me. He wanted to divorce his wife, leave his children, go against his religion and his conscience to marry me. To me, marriage has always meant sharing. It meant forever. Like the wonderful marriage of my grandparents, Floribel and Fred. Theirs wasn't a storybook romance by any means. They had plenty of yelling fights. You come right in here, Fred, and I'll be damned if I will, and so forth. But I knew as a child that no force on heaven or earth would be strong enough to pull those two apart. That's the kind of marriage I wanted. I respected this producer's talent, and he was attractive, young, and vital. But I couldn't allow myself to fall in love with him because of his wife and children. But because I was ambitious, and because he was a great catch, I struggled with my conscience long and painfully. Friends told me, why don't you marry him? He's a real talent, and he'll make your career. But in the end, I finally found the courage to turn him down. This decision put into motion a lot of unforeseen consequences. The producer, of course, suffered from a bad case of wounded pride. He immediately lost all interest in me and my career. But his wife heard some studio gossip after the romance was busted and over, and really lowered the boom. She had influence through some important relatives, so she was able to decree that one Lucille Ball would never again appear in any A picture at RKO. Then all my friends said, you dope. If you'd marry the guy, you'd be on top. Now you'll never make it at RKO, and the wife will get all the other Hollywood wives to blackball you, so no other major studios will hire you. My movie career just about ended then and there. But I never regretted that decision. I knew what it was like to lose a beloved father early in life. No child was going to be put through that torture because of me. When a man and woman work in close proximity in the highly charged atmosphere of movie making, emotions become very combustible. I remember Humphrey Bogart at a garden party watching the beautiful actresses in their diaphanous gowns walk by with their handsome actor escorts and saying to me with a wink, no wonder they all want to F each other all the time. But actors and actresses learn to switch their emotions on and off like light bulbs. Change, not constancy, characterizes the usual Hollywood romance. This producer's temporary interest in me caused a big roadblock in my career for a while, but I was convinced that eventually I would get going again. In the meantime, I had to give Hollywood a rest and look around for other showcases for my talent. I wound up trying radio. This turned out to be one of the smartest things I ever did. Early in 1938, I appeared on Jack Haley's weekly radio program, The Wonder Show. This led to a featured spot on Phil Baker's Hollywood radio show. I worked with some wonderful comics, Jack Carson and Al Pierce, as well as Jack Haley and Phil Baker. This gave me a name in the trade as a good feminine foil. I could flip a comedy line, which a lot of actresses couldn't do. In radio, I couldn't depend upon props or costumes or makeup. I had to rely on timing and tone of voice for comic effects, and this was invaluable training. My contract at RKO still had some time to run, and since I was well-liked on the lot, I soon became known as Queen of the Bees. My first bee picture, made on a low budget with little-known stars but with a strong storyline, was Next Time I Marry. James Ellison and Lee Bowman starred in it with me, and our director was Garson Kanin. One reviewer wrote, "Miss Ball, the former lanky and glass-eyed comedienne, has prettied herself up, put her eyebrows in the wrong place, and acquits herself with charm and gusto." My radio work had put new zip in my acting, and besides, Garson Kanin was a good director. New York Times critic Bosley Crowther called Next Time I Marry one of the best bee comedies of the year. Next, I was cast in the Annabelle series with Jack Oakey. The first was The Affairs of Annabelle, in which I was a glamorous movie star and a comic foil for Jack. When this did well at the box office, we made Annabelle Takes a Tour. My old beau, Ralph Forbes, was in this second picture, playing a rakish viscount. I also did some musicals with Kay Kaiser. My option was picked up each year with an automatic increase in salary, so that eventually my little $50 a week rose to $1,000. I began dating a director who was 20 years my senior. Al Hall was part of the Charlie Ruggles, Buster Keaton, Ed Sedgwick, and Bill and Mary Gargan group. They were all wonderful to me. We did things together almost like a family. Al had been married to Lola Lane and was in no hurry to marry again. I enjoyed his company, his advice, and guidance, but was not in love with him. For 2 years or so, we had a perfect understanding with no demands on either side. This easy, relaxed relationship continued until a Cuban skyrocket burst over my horizon. In 1939, I felt sufficiently affluent to buy my first fur coat, a great bushy silver fox with square shoulders 4 feet wide. I also hired my first personal maid, Harriet McCain. I first heard Harriet being interviewed on a radio program called Help Thy Neighbor. She said that her mother had worked for the Jack Bennies for 14 years and that she was looking for the same kind of job. When I interviewed Harriet, I didn't ask for any references, to her surprise. After about 5 minutes' talk, I decided I liked her looks and manner and asked, "What size uniform do you wear?" And that was that. She has been with me throughout the United States and Europe, traveling in the air, on the sea, and on the ground, and at home and on movie sets and backstage at the theater for 23 years. When I was doing Wildcat on Broadway in 1960 and 1961, and living in an Upper East Side apartment house, I was told that Negroes were not allowed to ride the front elevator. But I changed that rule in a hurry. Harriet and I were the first to integrate those $1,300 a month apartments, I'm glad to say. Back in 1939, Harriet would arrive at my house early in the morning to fix coffee and help me get dressed. Then we'd drive to the RKO studios in my bright red Buick convertible. There, Harriet would cook me a hearty breakfast. Steak, fried potatoes, hot biscuits, the works. Lupi Velez, who had to starve herself continually to keep her curves under control, would sweep into my dressing room, stamping and swearing, "God damn it, Lucille, you and your breakfasts!" Carol Lombard also dropped in often. She was so elegant. Her clothes looked as if they had been poured on her. I tried to copy the way she looked, but not the way she talked. Carol had a very lively vocabulary. She could get away with it. Not everybody can, and I didn't even try. But there were many things about Carol that were, oh boy, out of this world wonderful. She was class. She was a good actress, and she always looked great. More important, she had a lot of heart. No wonder Clark Gable adored her so. When I'm weighing a particularly difficult decision, sometimes I ask myself what Carol would have said, and it helps. She gave me lots of pointers on what she called studio behavior. Often, Harriet and I had a 2-hour drive up into the mountains or sagebrush country or wherever they were shooting outdoor scenes. We had to be at the studio by 4:45 a.m. in order to be ready to leave for location by 7. Sometimes, a day that began at 4 a.m. ended at 2 a.m. the following day if we stayed on location for night scenes. To alleviate the tedium of endlessly waiting between scenes,
Harriet and I played gin and poker. To Harriet's way of thinking, I didn't act like a potential movie star at all. I'd get ferociously hungry out there in the sagebrush, and since I had trouble keeping my weight up, I'd send Harriet to the food wagon for fried potato sandwiches. Harriet was ashamed to give such an order. She felt I should be nibbling on lettuce leaves and cottage cheese like the other players. But she soon learned that I like only the plain and hearty foods. But those long hours of waiting and of takes and retakes made me restless. My nerves would get frayed and I'd become irritated and short-tempered. After one of my outbursts, Harriet would go around apologizing for me. Oh, Miss Ball didn't mean it. She's not really mad at you. She's just hungry. I was almost 28 and hungry for a lot of things. The deep, enduring love of a man I could love in return. And children. And recognition as a performer. I was earning a very high salary. $1,000 a week for 40 weeks of the year at the studio, whether I worked or not, plus my radio earnings. But I knew something was missing from my life. In the spring of 1939, I was offered a small dramatic part in a B-movie, Five Came Back. My role was originally intended for Ann Southern, but she was too busy to do it, so somebody thought of me. I had done only comedy, but luckily I had a great director, John Farrow, and he helped me realize one of the best parts of my movie career. Five Came Back was a sleeper, which proved to be a solid gold hit. When it opened, the Rialto in New York went on a 24-hour schedule to accommodate the crowds. It was the film that gave my career a much-needed boost. Soon I was being told that the front office was grooming me for A-films and stardom at last. In line with this, I was sent east in December for personal appearances. And while you're in New York, the studio head told me, be sure and see the big Broadway hit Too Many Girls. We've bought the movie rights and George Abbott will direct. You may get a starring role in it. In New York, the studio press agents wanted to photograph me on the outdoor rink at Rockefeller Plaza doing a pratfall on the ice. I said, sure, why not? Bought myself a short black velvet skating outfit trimmed with white fur and a pair of long black tights. Russell Markert told me, for God's sake, not to go through with the stunt. He knew I'd do almost anything for a laugh, but he also knew I was no acrobat. You don't know how to fall properly, he warned me. You're apt to hurt yourself. I should have listened to him, but in those days I thought I was indestructible. After so many years in California, I guess I'd forgotten how hard ice can be. I fell over backward and landed with a mighty crack on my sacroiliac. I made all the big dailies in New York all right, and the rest of the country, too. They had to carry me off the rink on a stretcher, and I spent the next 10 days of my New York holiday in a hospital. From show business friends who popped in and out of my hospital room, I learned that the new Broadway musical, Too Many Girls, was a great hit. It was fast-paced and funny, with gorgeous girls and Rodgers and Hart songs. The sensation of the show, everyone agreed, was a 22-year-old Cuban named Desi Arnaz. The plot of Too Many Girls wasn't much. A beautiful, rich girl decides to go to college, and she takes along 4 football heroes who are really her bodyguards in disguise. Desi was cast as the South American football wonder. He sang with a heavy Spanish accent, danced a way-out conga, banged a conga drum, and strummed a guitar. From the way girls reacted to him, he was the Elvis Presley of his day. Offstage, he was dating film stars, stage stars, and all the leading debutantes, including the beautiful Brenda Fraser. My friends told me that this young nightclub entertainer was a nice guy, and that his overnight success on Broadway hadn't gone to his head at all. In his review of Too Many Girls, critic John Mason Brown called Desi at once attractive and modest. And in Variety, John Anderson wrote that in the title song, the stay-combed Desi Arnaz establishes his position as the show's glamour boy and clinches the Latinate supremacy on Broadway without reducing the part to a gigolodeon. When I recovered enough to hobble around, Russell Markert took me to see Too Many Girls. I couldn't take my eyes off this Desi Arnaz. A striped football jersey hugged his big shoulders and chest, while those narrow hips in tight football pants swayed to the catchy rhythms of the conga drum he was carrying. I recognized the kind of electrifying charm that can never be faked. Star quality. Then Desi opened his mouth and began talking in his own peculiar brand of broken English, and a great belly laugh burst out of me. Now, it's hard to make me laugh. I observe, I smile, but when I'm really amused, you can hear me a block away. Here was a stunning-looking male who was not only thrilling, but funny. What a combination. Russell asked me where I wanted to go after the show, and I said, La Conga. That's where Desi was appearing nightly after the show, singing and demonstrating the conga, then the sexiest and hottest dance in the country. But that particular night was Desi's night off, so I didn't get to meet him. In a few days, I went back to Hollywood. Too Many Girls was doing such a sellout business in New York that it would be months before George Abbott would be free to do the movie, so in the meantime, the studio gave me a co-starring role with Maureen O'Hara in Dance Girl Dance. Now, I discovered long ago that when you're cast in a part, first, you're cast physically. The producer couldn't care less about your soul shining from your big bright eyes. He looks to see if you're thin or fat, young or old, ugly or beautiful. I'm tall and wear clothes well, so first I was cast as a showgirl and a clothes horse. Then I played the other woman, the prostitute, and the hard-as-nails career girl. I guess I'm not the lady type. The refined-looking Maureen O'Hara got the role of the ballet dancer in Dance Girl Dance. I was the tough, wisecracking stripteaser. One reviewer said of Dance Girl Dance, Miss O'Hara, after the usual mishaps, realizes her ambition to become a ballet dancer, and Lucille Ball, her rival, becomes the sort of woman other women describe in a single word. Nevertheless, it is Miss Ball who brings an occasional zest into the film, especially that appearance in the burlesque temple where she stripteases. We were filming this scene the day I first met Desi on the RKO lot. I was wearing a slinky gold lamé dress slit up to my thigh, and my long reddish-gold hair fell over my bare shoulders. I also sported a fake black eye where my lover had supposedly socked me. George Abbott, who was lunching at the studio commissary with the New York cast of Too Many Girls, called me over. Desi reared back at the sight of me. What a hunk of woman, he gasped. At the end of the day's shooting, I was in slacks and a sweater, my face washed and my long red hair pulled neatly back in a bow. Desi didn't recognize me as the wild woman he had met at lunch and had to be introduced all over again. He invited me to dinner, and I accepted. We went to a nightclub, but instead of joining the conga line, we sat at a small table, talking and talking. I might as well admit here and now, I fell in love with Desi wham bang in 5 minutes. There was only one thing better than looking at Desi, and that was talking to him. Desi's real name, he told me, rolling all his R's magnificently, was Desiderio Alberto Arnaz y Diacha, the third. He was an only child and born with a proverbial silver spoon in his mouth. His family owned cattle ranches and townhouses in Cuba. Desi's father, a doctor of pharmacology, was mayor of Santiago for 10 years. His mother, Dolores, was a famous beauty and one of the heirs to the Bacardi rum fortune. At 16, Desi had his own speedboat and motor car and 3 different homes. He had never faced a worry or a strain. He loved his life and everyone loved him. Then came one of those revolutions that frequently erupted in Cuba. Desi and his mother were alone at one of the family ranches when he awoke to shouts and gunfire. From the window, he could see soldiers on horseback slaughtering cattle and setting fire to outbuildings. Desi's father was in Havana at the time, 600 miles away at the other end of the island. Desi's mother ran through the house collecting all the loose cash she could find and her pet chihuahua. A cousin arrived just in time to rush them into safe hiding. Desi and his mother, looking back, saw their house in flames. Mi casa! She screamed and screamed until it was out of sight. Whenever they passed rebel soldiers to avoid attack or recognition, Desi would wave and shout, Viva la revolución! He and his mother stayed in hiding in an aunt's house in Havana for 6 months. Desi's father, along with the rest of the Cuban Senate, was locked up in the Moro Castle Fortress. All the family property was confiscated. They lost everything. When he was finally released, Desi's father decided to go to Florida and start over. Desi would join him soon. Mrs. Arnaz would stay with a sister in Cuba until they had enough money saved to send for her. Desi was 17 when he arrived penniless in Miami with only the clothes on his back. He found his father in a dingy rooming house
heating canned beans on a hot plate. But even this place was more than they could afford, so they moved into an unheated warehouse filled with rats.